And then in the next few years, when the synthetic rubber shortage, when the rubber shortage developed as a result of the war in the Far East cutting off the natural rubber supplies, the Humble Company was called on to make butadiene, which was a component of one type of synthetic rubber, and later butyl rubber, which was the rubber in itself. And so having had that initial experience with the toluene contract, I was asked to take on the job of negotiating and preparing the contracts in the rubber field. And this occupied my full attention for the next 4 or 5 years. You asked particularly about the people, and you probably never met or even never heard of Dr. Vos. He was a Dane, Ernst Frederick Vos, who was the chief engineer of the manufacturing or refining department. He was a brilliant engineer, but being a Dane, he lacked the ability to express himself well in English, and so I sort of had to supplement his efforts, much as Heinz Baker had supplemented the work of Harry Wise by putting his thoughts into agreeable English, and in general answering his questions from time to time. But Dayton Wild was also, he's the father, of course, of Bill Wild and Henry Wild and Carlton Wild, was also in on many of these meetings. He was in charge of our research, our manufacturing, our refining research. An extremely smart person who knew all the details of the various components that needed to be put together to make toluene and to make these various types of synthetic rubber. It was very pleasant to be with, and we went on many, many trips together to Washington and to New York. There were numerous other people that had a part in this process. The chief accountant of the refining department was a man by the name of Eddie Fitzgerald, a little Irishman who was not too smart, and he relied on me tremendously to get him out of all sorts of accounting difficulties, which we managed to do somehow. And there was another man, an engineer at the Baytown Refinery by the name of Art Draker. In his latter years, he lived in Tanglewood, and dropped dead one day on Tanglewood Boulevard only about a couple of years ago. He went with us on a number of these trips to Washington and New York in connection with these contracts. And Thomas W. Moore was the employee relations manager at the Baytown Refinery, and though in the early years I didn't have much contact with him, in the later years I did. He was an extremely nice person. He lived in a house right on the 12th hole of the Houston Country Club golf course. Another one who came into the picture at a little later date was Russell Venn, whom of course you knew. Russell was a real bright chemical engineer, and he was my counterpart in preparing and administering all of the various multiple contracts that arose out of the two synthetic rubber projects. And we made many, many trips together to Washington, New York on these matters. So this turned out to be a much more interesting part of my law career with Humble than the first three or four years, because it involved some travel and the meeting of new people, particularly people in the Army and people with the Reconstruction Finance Company subsidiaries engaged in the production of synthetic rubber. I remember that one of the lawyers for one of the RFC subsidiaries was a man who was then courting Margaret Truman. And he spoke oftenly of Margaret Truman, but he apparently didn't have any success because she didn't marry him. She married an editor of Time magazine. I had very little contact with Harry Wise until he became interested in Rice Institute matters. It was then Rice Institute and not Rice University. And he knew of my interest in Rice, and so he began to call me up to his office and ask me about Rice, what his needs were for the future and so forth, and even asked me to go out and talk to a number of key people at Rice and come back and tell him what they said. He wanted to know what was wrong with Rice and what he could do for Rice. Mr. Wise then had a fair fortune. By today's standards, it would not seem so high, but by the standards of 1941-42, it was substantial, and he wanted to do something for Rice, as he said. And about that time, he was elected to the Rice board as a member of the board, and that gave him an additional motive for doing something for Rice. So that is my only contact with him. And whereas most others in the company, with the exception of Hines Baker, were scared to death of Harry Wise because he could be rather short-tempered, and if you ever interrupted him in a conversation, he grew furious. That was one of the cardinal advices everyone got: don't interrupt Mr. Wise. I think Rex did that once. He never quite fully recovered from the adventure. But at any rate, I had no contact with Mr. Wise on humble business matters, but my contact was on Rice affairs, and was very, very satisfactory. Appreciated what I did, and I was glad to interest him further in Rice. I neglected to mention earlier on that in 1919, the Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, which was the original Standard Oil Company, the one made famous and known as the Standard Oil Trust, bought a 50% interest in Humble Oil Refining Company, and thereby obtained technical control of the company. I'm not going to go into all the details of that, but Standard Oil Company, the trust, had a bizarre history in Texas, and prior companies owned by Standard had been kicked out of Texas on the ground that they'd violated the Texas antitrust laws. And so the name Standard Oil had a rather bad odor in Texas, and in 1921, of course, long before I came to the company, there'd been a lawsuit in which Standard's acquisition of 50% of the stock of Humboldt was challenged as a violation of the Texas antitrust laws. And luckily, Humboldt, with the help of Hines Baker, and I think Frank Andrews was in on the case too, won the case. And so that matter was not quite put to rest, but at least laid aside. But the burning issue remained that Humboldt had to run its own business as substantially as possible and not be guided day by day by advice from Standard Oil of New Jersey. And so one of my additional tasks became as a kind of a lieutenant to Hines Baker to read various files and contracts and other matters to see that they did not, by their language, imply too much day-to-day control over Humboldt. It's a rather technical consideration that may not appeal to you very much. Obviously, if a shareholder like Standard Oil of New Jersey owns more than 50% of the stock of a company, they can elect its directors from time to time, but there was and is a specific statute in Texas providing that the control of two companies cannot be brought together under a single management. And whereas that's probably obsolete today, in those early days it was not. So one of my tasks was as a kind of a policeman in that area. It was not a very enviable assignment, because part of the job consisted of going to see some of the people in New York with the Standard Oil of New Jersey and asking them to rewrite, or in the future to write, to use different expressions in the correspondence they used with Humboldt and in the contracts they wrote in which Humboldt was involved. This state of affairs continued down past the war years until about 1946, thereabouts, at which time we moved back to the Milford House, as you may recall, because by that time Dale had been born and we were simply crowded out of the Coleridge Street house, and we lived in Milford for 4 years. And at that time, my traveling to the East even increased over what it had been. I think Mother said that I was gone once, at least once a month, and maybe more than that. I remember I went to New York twice in 1 week in those years on various matters. They expanded from government contract work to work involving relations with Standard Oil of New Jersey and various other matters. In the early days, our trips to New York were on the train, that is, most of them in the 1940s, when the war was on, you couldn't get a priority on the airplane, so you had to ride the train. It took 2 days and two nights to get to New York on the train, which is something that almost unthinkable these days, but we did it many, many times, and it was 2 days and two nights coming back. Well, at any rate, one of the subjects I got into after the war contracts simmered down somewhat was the Tidelands matter. I think that you were present one time when I made a speech on the Tidelands subject to some teachers in Louisiana. And the great issue then was there was this huge amount of land off the coast, all of the coasts of the United States, but we were particularly concerned with that off of Texas and Louisiana, in which oil was being discovered, and there was a real issue as to who owned the minerals. The theory was that the coastal states owned all of the lands out to 3 miles from their shore, but Texas claimed a special ownership out to 3 leagues, because at the time it became a member of the Union in 1845, it had expressly reserved all of the public lands within its boundaries, and its seaward boundaries at that time were 3 marine leagues from the shore. Now that became a considerable controversy. All this while, the drilling for oil was proceeding out into the Gulf of Mexico, and particularly off the coast of Louisiana. And so we at the Humble Company were particularly interested in fostering legislation which was pending in the Congress, which would release to the several coastal states all of the lands within their traditional boundaries. If this were done, this would of course give Texas all of the lands and the minerals out to 3 leagues from shore, and give to Louisiana all of the lands and minerals out to 3 miles from shore. That legislation was not at first successful, and some lawsuits proceeded to trial in which the claims of Texas were considered by the United States Supreme Court, and the court held against Texas and indeed against Louisiana in those various cases, and held that despite the reservations contained in the annexation proceedings under which Texas became a part of the Union, the United States had paramount rights in these offshore lands. And so the task then became a matter of getting some legislation out of Congress which would release back to the coastal states all of these lands within their coastal boundaries. And we had a lobbyist in Washington who worked on this matter by the name of David Gray. Mother became a friend of his wife after Dave died. He lived at the Shoreham Hotel, and I worked with him closely on various aspects of the Tidelands matter. I wrote articles on the subject. One of the articles I wrote was with Bob Hardwick, which appeared in the Texas Law Review, in which we were advancing the proposition that to be consistent with the Constitution, all these lands should be released to the several coastal states. Well, at any rate, it came out this way. Legislation was passed by the Congress in which these lands were within the coastal boundaries of the several states were released to the several states, but that the lands beyond the so-called coastal boundaries were held to be subject to the ownership at least by the United States and not the several states. And that matter eventually came to an end, but it took an awful lot of doing to even get it into that shape. After that, my essential duties, since I was fairly familiar with the Washington scene, my essential job became that of handling some of the matters relating to the sale of natural gas by the company. The Federal Power Commission had been given authority to regulate certain sales of gas in interstate commerce, and everybody in the industry thought and assumed that that didn't mean sales at the wellhead, but only meant sales after the gas had been transported to a far distance by an interstate pipeline company. But in 1954, the Supreme Court held otherwise, and so all of the local sales of gas in interstate commerce for resale became subject to the control of the Federal Power Commission, and that required a group of lawyers to keep up with and to make the necessary filings with the Federal Power Commission with respect to sales of natural gas in interstate commerce for resale. So it devolved, that was the next job that devolved on me. And we had a sort of a group in there from time to time. Bill Merrill was one who helped me from time to time, and Bill Holloway was also in that group. And those, I'm sure, are the best years of Bill Holloway's career, because although he never did anything tremendously important, he was a good leg man. He'd go anywhere you wanted to, minor and errands and otherwise, and handle such things as you didn't want to do. And he was tremendously loyal. And so I began making a lot of trips to Washington and indeed to New York on those matters, and that's where I first came in contact with Bernard Foster. We needed a Washington lawyer to represent us on these matters after 1954. And so I remember one hot day in the midsummer, I guess of 1954, when Rex and I went to see Bernard Foster for the first time. Barney was in an office which was not air-conditioned, and it was really stifling hot. We sat in that little office and talked to Barney, and he was so glad to about get a real client. He didn't know what to do, because he'd apparently been having a hard time. And so we ended up by employing Bernard Foster and his firm to represent it. So I think the tape's coming to an end. I'm going to turn it over now.